Well, I think we can begin. It's a great pleasure to welcome you all today to the LSE Department of Anthropology and the International Inequalities Institute celebration and discussion of Jonathan Parry's long-awaited magnificent magnum opus. I've got the book here, Aisha, you will be pleased. Classes of Labor, Work and Life in a Central Indian Steel Town, written in collaboration with Ajay TG. Thank you for joining us today. Since this is a celebration and a discussion, we were keen for us all to see each other. So if you can, please turn your cameras on. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Alpa Shah. I'm an associate professor of anthropology at the LSE and also convening one of the research themes at the International Inequalities Institute. It's a real privilege to be introducing the book today and the discussants. Classes of Labor is based on fieldwork conducted by Johnny and Ajay in the hot, dusty plains amidst the industrial sprawl of that sprouted up around this gigantic steel plant in Bhilai, in what is now the Indian state of Chhattisgarh. Erected from the mid-50s with Russian backing, this steel plant was to represent India's first Prime Minister Nehru's vision of the future, his temple of modernity. Johnny, having completed his research for his earlier book, Death in Benares, looking for a new research issue and a new site, at the age of 50, landed in Bhilai. The fieldwork took place over several spells, beginning with almost a year in 1993, and then several months, sometimes three or four at a go, almost, I think, every year for the next 20. I've lost count, but I recall that for much of the time that Johnny was supervising my PhD, he was in India. I was fortunate to have shared a very minute part of Johnny's fieldwork on several occasions while conducting my own in the neighboring state of Jharkhand between 2000 and 2002. I vividly recall arriving in Bhilai after a 36-hour journey. The train had simply stopped in the middle of the tracks for 16 hours, as they so often did in India in those days. But I was welcomed enthusiastically by Johnny and Ajay, who whisked us all off on his motorbike. They'd lined up some very, very packed days, including sharing a whiskey or two with this late Somwaru, who was like a brother to Johnny in the narrow lanes of the Satnami Para, visiting his more posh friends who lived in the smart houses set up by the Bhilai steel plant for its permanent workers, and the offices of the editor-in-chief of the regional daily newspaper, the Deshbandhu. And of course, there was always some diligent note-taking that was squeezed in. Ajay was charming, he was sharp, he was full of insightful reflections, and I could understand that his passion, his friendship, and his intellectual company was a large part of why Johnny kept returning. He couldn't stop the fieldwork, why it grew and grew over the years, why it went from the neighborhoods into the public sector factory, into the private factories, and then into the construction sites. Johnny has written at length about this relationship in an article in Focal, which I strongly recommend, as it's not in the book. It's such a pleasure to have Ajay with us here today as well. Thank you, Ajay, for joining in from India. If in London, Johnny came across to strangers, at least, as slightly reserved, in the field, he was the opposite. Laughing, chatting, highly personable. In those days, we stayed at the house that was rented out by John Darshan. This was the filmmaking training project that Margaret Dickinson, Johnny's wife, whom the book is dedicated to, had admirably set up and ran for many years in Bhilai, with the aim of training those who would not normally get a chance to learn how to make film, documentary films, an opportunity to make them. In fact, the clip of the women construction workers as you were coming in was made by John Darshan trainees for the UN International Labour Organization. Back at the John Darshan house, one afternoon, We found the cheeky young cook, Jeevan, his name was, lazily sprawled out over the grass lawn, and he was with one of the Jandarshan trainees, and they were laughing and chatting and talking away. And I asked both of them, "Aap log kya kar rahe? You know, what are you guys up to?" And Jeevan replied with this very deadpan, you know, straight-faced look, "Research." He'd obviously picked up a thing or two about anthropological fieldwork from Johnny. We see this field very much in the book, in the burning furnaces of the coke ovens where Johnny spent several months with the coke oven workers. We see it in the romance and tragedies of marriage and sexual liaisons of women construction workers who Johnny and Ajay had become close to. We see it in the stories of the human sacrifices of the people that were needed to construct the steel plant. The power of the analysis is that it is not just based on the fieldwork on the factory floor, but also an analysis of life itself, the way in which life and work are truly interrelated. So if the first part of the book is on work, the second part is on life, on birth, on childhood, marriage, sex, death, suicide. What unfolds through the book is a division of the working class that is salient in many parts of India between those that are considered the aristocracy of labor, who had salaried regular jobs, and those whose conditions are extremely precarious. This is a distinction for which Johnny uses the emic terms nokri and kam. So nokri for those who had formal jobs with regular salaries, job security, pensions, calm for the rest who are in highly precarious contract, temporary, informal work, who are faced really with utter destitution. Johnny shows that this distinction is so important that the two types of workers have completely different lifestyles, life chances, life rituals even. The division between those who have nokri and those who have calm runs through Johnny's entire analysis of kinship and marriage practices, suicide patterns, ideas of childhood. At the heart of the book is an analysis of the intersections of class, caste, gender, and regional ethnicity in contemporary India. Johnny argues that class is more salient than all other identities in most contexts, the most important marker of inequality when it comes to the low-caste Satnamis. Overall, he argues that the working class has become increasingly differentiated as the structuration of caste has declined. Driving this analysis is the question of whether the working class could ever unite to challenge the inequalities that frame their condition. I think that many would agree that this is one of the most important books on the shaping of the post-independence Indian working class. And though we would have loved to get together in person for a glass of wine to celebrate, it also felt important to mark this moment with a virtual celebration and a discussion. A discussion that would give everybody a flavor of the book, but also in the tradition of the LSE Anthropology Research Seminar, at which Johnny remains a sharp, insightful interlocutor, a discussion which would pose some critical questions to Johnny and his analysis. So I can't say how delighted I am to welcome six fantastic discussants who have each worked on aspects of issues Johnny addresses in their own respective contexts, whether in South Asia, whether in Brazil, whether in the UK, whether in Southern Africa or in India. They are in the order in which they will speak, which is determined by the context of what they will speak about. Geert Denev, Professor of Social Anthropology and South Asia Studies at the University of Sussex, who has worked a lot on textile and garment workers in Tamil Nadu, amongst other things. Maxime Bolt, Associate Professor of Development Studies at Oxford, who has worked on labor and land in Southern Africa. Nanika Mathur, Associate Professor in Anthropology of South Asia at Oxford, who has worked on bureaucracy and the state, amongst many other things. Nate Roberts, Associate Cultural Anthropologist at the University of Göttingen, who has worked on Dalit and Christian conversion in the slums of Southern India. Christian Strumpel, a research associate in the Department of Anthropology at Hamburg, who worked in Rourkela, a neighboring steel plant in Jharkhand in India. Massimiliano Molona, Associate Professor of Anthropology at Goldsmiths, who's worked on steel factories both here in Sheffield in the UK and in Brazil. Over the course of the last month, we've had a lot of fun together brainstorming the book and today's event. And if there's anything that was conclusive that was emerging out of our discussions, it is that at 702 pages, the book is actually a little too short. So at the end of the discussant comments, we will invite Johnny to respond before opening up to the floor. So without taking up any more of your time, I hand over to Geert De Neef to open up with his comments. Geert.
Thanks, Alpa. I'm very pleased to be able to say a few words about a book that I've long been looking forward seeing in print. It's a great moment. I would like to make sort of three comments or observations and end with a question for Johnny as well. I think the first thing is to say that this book is obviously very ambitious, and it's probably fair to say that it is the first study in over 20 years that seeks to draw or redraw the landscape of Indian labor. Since the earlier work of Breman, Holmstrom, Harris, Joshi and Joshi, and many others reviewed in chapter two, few have attempted since then to map the Indian economy and society in as comprehensive a way as this book does. So here we have a new map to make sense not only of how people in India are inserted into particular labor markets and classes, but also of how their specific insertion is shaping their social lives much more broadly, as Alpa just mentioned. The landscape that emerges is one that seeks to replace an earlier image of a mountain slope with that of a more closed-off citadel of nokri, against which all other kaam or wage labor looks like a rather bare plain. The evidence given to us by Johnny here is very convincing. And in the case of Bilai, there clearly is a labor elite with benefits and rewards that the majority outside of the permanent workers in the steel plant can only dream of. So my first question, perhaps not so much for Johnny, but for the other scholars of Indian labor and the informal economy, is this. What does the landscape of industrial labor, and indeed this particular class divide, look like in the many towns, cities, and villages where there is no BSP, RSP, or DSP present? Or in other words, in places where the forces shaping the landscape of labor are not driven by a central domineering publicly owned enterprise, of which much of the surrounding industrial environment feeds, as was the case in Bilai. So I'm of course thinking here of a place like Tirupur in Tamil Nadu, where I myself carry out research, where all that we have are a multitude of private enterprises, smaller and larger, and many subcontracting units in which no one has anything resembling the perks of the permanent BSP worker. So how do we apply this class analysis to such locations where this top layer is effectively missing? Do we only have one labor class here, the underclass resembling Johnny's private and informal economy? Or do we resort to a picture of a slope there with gradations of security, permanency, wages, and so on? Or does a sharp class divide perhaps fall somewhere else? My second comment relates to something new to me in Johnny's book, which regards the political implications of his class analysis, particularly in terms of citizenship. Class, Johnny argues, undermines the equal claims of citizens. While the state is supposed to guarantee the rights of all its citizens, what we see in Bilai is that through its policies and legislation, the state itself has paradoxically created a class division that has produced substantive citizenship for only a small and indeed shrinking minority of people and workers, while for the many, meaningful citizenship remains a largely unachievable goal. So Johnny points out that this divide between citizen and denizen, those who are denied citizenship, is of the state's own making, and that this is what contributes to the undoing of Nehru's vision for democracy in India. Or in Johnny's own words, it is not caste but class that robs Indian democracy of its reconstructive energy. In Bilai, indeed, the labor elite pursued its own interests, leaving those below them largely to fend for themselves and their own rights. Now, I think it's right to say that most of us can recognize this pattern across India. Johnny asks at the end of the first chapter, What is wrong with Nehru's vision? And also, what possibilities does it still have? And I think the answer to that is still very much open. Now, I would put it this way. Did the vision, this idea of expanding democracy and citizenship through flagship projects of inclusion like BILAI, did this vision fade because of its impossible implementation? I.e., could it never be extended to more than just a small core of working class people across India during its heydays and then to a much smaller and shrinking population later on? In other words, could it never be expanded more widely? Or was perhaps the vision itself misguided in that from the outset, it tied rights and entitlements and citizenship to employment rather than seeing to guarantee such rights for all irrespective of employment status? So perhaps the recent right to food bill, the right to work bill, the right to education bill are all trying to steer neoliberal India into a direction of guaranteeing at least some basic citizenship rights for everyone. But the verdict on their success is obviously still out there too. Let me conclude with a final comment, which regards Johnny's analysis of informal labor in India, in BILAI rather. Chapters 8 and 9 of the book give us a fascinating insight into the private sector surrounding the steel plant, as well as the further informal economy, with a focus on construction work and litter picking in particular, which are really fascinating. Here, Johnny sketches a picture of gradually less secure, less well rewarded, more taxing work without any form of union protection or representation. Now, one individual here in this informal economy, particularly in the construction sector, caught my attention. His name is Kedarnath, who belongs to an untouchable caste from rural Bihar. Having worked in various jobs across India, he landed in BILAI in 1984, where after ups and downs, he finally established himself as a rather successful construction contractor. By 2003, Kedarnath finally established himself as a rather, you know, successful contractor that had worked on different sites, had invested in cement mixers, in a pickup truck, invested in land, and indeed also bought a house in a middle-class residential neighborhood. We don't learn very much about his life here, but I did wonder if, by Johnny's own definition, he could be called middle class now. And so I wonder in what ways he might differ from the permanent BSP workforce. Of course, I can see that Kedarnath's life is probably far less secure than that of a BSP worker. But on the other hand, it also reveals a remarkable route of upward mobility, one which is of course highly gendered. To put it more directly, are there any other routes to middle-class status in BILAI than that of Nokri? And could self-employment, as in the case of Kedarnath, the route taken by him through contracting work, possibly be one of them? Thank you.
Thank you, Geert. Over to Max Bolt. Max, are you with us?
Yeah.
Great.
So Johnny's book walks the reader around a labor landscape of astounding breadth. At one end of the scale is the enormous steel plant whose sometimes extreme work conditions, explosive fires, molten metal, might initially conceal the middle-class lives enabled by employment. Here then is a world of protection in a formal register of jobs, income levels, and working conditions. At the other end of the scale, as already introduced by Geert, is the expanse of informal labor most sharply epitomized by disproportionately women construction workers and waste pickers on BILAI's fringes. Not only lacking labor law protections, their work is characterized by routine exposure to sexual exploitation that in turn sustains a sense of shame among their income poor and powerless husbands. Work situations are not always physically separated, of course. Precarious temporary laborers in the plant increasingly do the more menial tasks so that recognized workers shift into supervisory roles. Two binary oppositions guide the reader. The first, as you've already heard, is Nokri versus Kam, regular salaried employment versus day labor. This, we're shown, is the emic, sociologically significant distinction that structures work and life in Bilai. It interacts with another, formal versus informal employment. These, Johnny points out, are not the same. Nokri is a gloss on thoroughgoing security. Formal employment is a bureaucratic category, and regulation is at best unevenly observed. There's a huge range in the degree to which labor law is followed, from the steel plant's permanent workforce, through to patchy application beyond that core, through to the de facto non-existence of the law on the informal fringes. But this is really thrown into relief in the world of the private factories that have grown up around the steel plant, supplying to it, using its outputs, and benefiting from the consumer market that it anchors. Here, distinctions cross-cut and proliferate. Small factories, to a large extent, operate in the regulatory shadows. Big, bureaucratically organized factories offer a minority of workers the security of Nokri, while they rely on much larger numbers of people who engage in the short-term income generation of Kham. The latter have been further fragmented. Political struggles led to greater recognition of contract workers, better pay and entitlements, although not the proper long-term security of Nokri. But those changes were possible because a further outer ring of workers was created of truly precarious temporary workers, extending some protections bought off one stratum, now permanent contract workers, who thus benefited from earlier mobilization, while another vulnerable stratum replaced them at a further remove from legal safeguards. So, if the steel plant is, in a sense, the model of ideal Nokri informal status, it's in the factories that both are thrashed out, at the limits of recognition and entitlement. Classes of Labour suggests the contingency of actually existing formal status. The plant, big factories, small factories, and informal work are on a scale of greater to lesser bureaucratization. Contractors protect employers from labor law and hold workers at a distance from it. Lives beyond labor match this pattern, with schools, housing, and even marriage counselors immersing steelworkers in an all-encompassing administrative edifice. A liberalizing Indian state has weighed in overwhelmingly on the side of employers, deprioritizing labor law, where it got in the way of market flexibility and cost cutting, and with its opposition to worker activism, setting the tone for pacification by means of limited entitlements. Conversely, union activism has an important role pushing employers to actually take formal status seriously. And it's notable that in setting out the world of the private factories and the ways workers are categorized and differentially recognized, historical depth is grounded most acutely in the dramatic story of union activity and suppression. So given all this talk of contingency, uneven enforcement and the politics of recognition, it's unsurprising that Johnny presents the formal-informal distinction as less consequential than the binary of Nokri and Kham. After all, formality and informality break down, while the Nokri-Kham distinction remains intact. My question, though, is how exactly do they relate? How are they mutually constitutive? How do Nokri and Kham respond to and shape institutions, institutional process, and institutionalized difference? Nokri, we're told, is permanence, but it's also legal. Is it then just an emic gloss? After all, coming at this as a non-Indianist, some of these distinctions are not entirely unfamiliar beyond India. Essentially, middle-class permanent workforces with properly enforceable rights and unions in cahoots with the state versus workers who lack all of this or the power to do much about it. Or if Nokri isn't just an emic gloss, does the Nokri versus Kham distinction more proactively shape the institutional landscape of possibilities? Does it inflect a moral economy of how workers can or should be treated? Given that the steel plant and large factories are basically compliant with the law, we're told, but only in relation to permanent workforces, How much normative, as opposed to descriptive, valence does the ideal of Nokri have?
Great, thank you so much, Max. Maybe move on to Nainika?
Okay, so I have to begin with a phrase that I learned from Johnny when I first met him more than a decade back in Berlin at the JNU campus. I'd then gone to hear him present a talk that I now see has taken a slightly different shape as a chapter in this book. And after the seminar, we got chai at the SSS canteen. Now, at this first meeting, we discussed a talk we had both attended in London, actually at the LSE, earlier in the year. Now, while both of us were, as interns so often are, somewhat critical of the paper, Johnny used a phrase to sum up what was the problem with it. It was based on what he termed weekend ethnography. Now, ever since that meeting, my benchmark for reading ethnographic work has really been to question whether this is something that Johnny would term weekend ethnography. We can quite safely say the class of labor is anything but weekend ethnography. Johnny begins the book by stating in the preface that he first began fieldwork in Bhilai in 1993 and returned to the site regularly over the next 20 years with a total of approximately 34 months of fieldwork, or as he puts it, of being there. Now, when Johnny himself refers to this long period of fieldwork, it is more to note that this is different from the synchronic moment that more typical ethnographic work involves. But he doesn't dwell further on what the implications of this are for knowledge production. My brief comments on this remarkable and, you know, extremely elegantly written book are going to be centered on what work time, specifically this long-term ethnographic, political, and personal engagement with Bhilai and Chhattisgarh, is doing for the book Classes of Labor. I'm going to tackle this question of time through a focus on the latter part of the book, that which is termed life rather than labor, though as this work very sharply shows, labor and life are inextricably entangled, as are the categories of gender, caste, and class, very much as Alpa noted in her opening comments. Classes of Labor is able to quite authoritatively make claims on what was and what now is, in other words, on social change. Not just how notions of childhood, adulthood, marriage, divorce, remarriage have changed, but also how these changes cut across lines of class, caste, and gender. So for instance, the book shows that the childhood experience of local Chhattisgarhis has decisively changed since the steel plant was set up. Previously, the life trajectories of the two classes of labor were relatively uniform, but now there are certain notable divergences. The quest to reproduce the employment hierarchy to get the deeply desired nokris that both Alpa and Max have talked about, especially by the sons of BSP employees, has subordinated childhood to what he terms an educational end. In the chapter on marriage and remarriage, the book argues that marriage among the labor elite has become more stable and the disapproval of divorce has grown. The scenario is not quite the same for the labor class, where the expectations that spouses have of each other are less exacting, intercaste marriages are rising, and the power of caste panchayats is waning. Of all the chapters, it is this one on marriage where the book most powerfully, to my mind, is able to demonstrate ethnographically that caste structuration is being weakened as class structuration is enhanced. At the same time, the role of the state and its many wings is becoming stronger. The role of the state becomes even more pronounced in a rather sinister way in the chapter on suicide. Here, Johnny makes the argument that suicide has risen enormously over the last 20 years in the industrial area around Bhilai, and that suicide is disproportionately concentrated in the aristocracy of labor. He's careful to show that this isn't a poor but happy sort of argument, but rather he does the intellectual work of locating suicide rates as a product of society in a Durkheimian sense. So the questions such as when does childhood end, adulthood begin, and how are these stages of a life cycle experienced? How is marriage changing? Is divorce increasing or are marriages as stable as before? What of remarriage and caste and class? Is suicide really going up? And if so, why? These are all really big questions that hold significance in contemporary India. And Johnny answers them quite definitively and through evocative life histories, as well as through the use of some statistical data in a manner that shows the infinite possibilities of ethnography to illuminate the world. Thinking further about the time and labor that has gone into the writing of this book, I want to note a few facets that I found interesting and that once again relate back to the question of situated long-term committed ethnography in a relatively bounded site. The first is that much of the persuasive power of this work, again, for me at least, comes from the tracking of individual biographies over a long period of time. We already know of Ankulu and his errant wife from an earlier publication, but we meet a whole new cast of people from Bamleshwari to Chotu to the Kedarnath that you referred to as well. This deep dive into richly textured individual and community lives apart, the persuasiveness also comes from the frank willingness in this work to correct previous positions and the noting of the loose ends that remain on despite this almost quarter of a century engagement with Chhattisgarh. So for instance, Johnny notes that in an earlier publication, he had suggested that it is the children of the labor elite who are most susceptible to domestic violence, but he is now not so confident about this claim. Another striking aspect of this book is the way in which it shifts the framing and the substance of trends that dominate the news cycle. So for instance, instead of the gruesome honor killings that consistently make it to newspaper headlines and Twitter trends, we read about the relative nonchalance with which second marriages or intercaste unions are regarded in Bhilai. Similarly, with suicides, the public consensus is that there is a surge in farmer suicides in India due to the incessant commercialization of agriculture. But Johnny turns attention to suicides amongst the rural landless as well as the labor aristocracy. So on this, my final observation, Johnny notes that he had no intention of writing on suicide initially, but given the wide prevalence of it, felt he had to include it in. He's also collected robust numerical data on suicides in three bastis, which cuts through the statistical fog of the state. This aspect of being in a place so long that you're compelled to engage with observable trends that you might wish to look away from, as well as the power to produce data of a form that is otherwise not available through governmental or developmental agencies like NGOs, is extremely valuable, and again, only possible through sustained engagement with the place and its people. So this brings me to my question. I know Johnny had asked Alpa to ask us all to end with a question, and so this is mine. This would be a slightly mean question were it not for the fact that the book is already published and much applauded. So the question really is that, Johnny, did you take this long over Bhilai because you deliberately wanted to track change and produce the narrative that we now see here, this extremely persuasive, compelling, and robust narrative? Or was it more because books and fieldwork take the time that they take? Thank you.
Thank you so much, Nanika. We'll move over to Nate. I'm sure everybody's burning to ask questions and pitch in, but just hold your horses for a little bit longer and over to Nate. Nate Roberts.
An unresolved disagreement among the academic commentariat has been over how to explain the continued salience of caste in India beyond the traditional village context. On one side are those who have argued that state efforts to ameliorate the worst aspects of caste through affirmative action programs, through hate crime laws, and indeed through the very act of collecting data on caste as perversely perpetuating the very phenomena these efforts were intended to remedy. On the other side are those who hold that caste attitudes, often glossed as feudal holdovers, are just too deeply ingrained, entrenched in the Indian psyche to be dislodged by state policy, and regard Nehruvian secularism as either heroically well-intentioned or as an inauthentic Western import, but in either case, doomed from the get-go by the sheer recalcitrance of the mass of Indians. Never, to my knowledge, has either interpretive framework been systematically put to the test. Jonathan Parry's Classes of Labor presents something like a natural experiment, one which offers qualified support for select elements of both positions, though the overwhelming weight of evidence confirms the overwhelming power of the state to dismantle caste, even if that power has only rarely been used. That it did not do so more completely in Bhilai, and in fact retrenched certain aspects of caste, even as it created an entirely new caste-like division among laborers more or less out of whole cloth, owes more to the fact that Bhilai, like India's other temples of modernity, was designed not to replace private capital, but to offer a row of teats for private capital to suck on. It aimed not to uplift the masses of Indian laborers, but to create a small but exemplary class of laborers to serve as a model for the rest to follow, even as state policy actively prevented them from successfully doing so, including by crushing their independent organizing efforts and refusing to implement labor protection laws it itself had enacted. How caste did and did not break down in Belai varies instructively between its two principal milieu, the company town of Belai's state-created labor aristocracy, that is Naukri, and among the insecure labor force living in Bastis. Considering the first two of three traditional features of the caste order, hierarchy and functional interdependence, better termed caste-wise exploitation, the former has all but disappeared as an aspect of public life in both milieu, while the latter has ceased entirely to exist. Exploitation and hierarchy endure, but the exploiter slash superior is as likely to be a Dalit mason, Dalit labor contractor, or Dalit from the labor aristocracy moonlighting as an employer of insecure Basti workers as he is to be a non-Dalit, as are those they exploit. Caste remains salient only with respect to the third traditional feature of caste order, separation, but only in the condition, specifically in the continued practice of endogamy. Workers commonly interdine, welcome one another into their houses, etc., especially, and have warm personal relationships, especially among the labor aristocracy. Endogamy persists, but how it does so differs radically across these two milieu. In the Bastis and among insecure labor, while at least 90% of first marriages are endogamous, the overwhelming majority of men and women leave their partner for new ones, often having three or four or more marriages in a lifetime. Secondary marriages, unlike first marriages, are rarely endogamous and frequently, in fact, cross ethno-linguistic boundaries. Children are officially classified as belonging to the caste of the father, but the majority have mothers and other close kin belonging to other castes. The result is that children not infrequently have grandparents belonging to four different castes. Thus, the boundaries of kinship and caste no longer coincide, nor do personal loyalties and the sentimental ties that follow. In the township and among the aristocracy of labor, on the other hand, Nehruvian social engineering followed Brahminical norms to the extent that company policy does everything in its power to preserve first marriages and prevent subsequent ones, even to the extent of penalizing divorce and requiring company permission for remarriage. Relations among family of different castes are, however, if anything, even more amicable than in the Bastis, including across the Dalit-non-Dalit division. Indeed, Parry argues compellingly that the cultural unity and mutual recognition among Belai's labor aristocracy is to some extent enhanced by their common opposition to the insecure laborers of the Basti, both Dalit and non-Dalit, who they together exploit both within and outside the factory setting, and who they have come to scorn and use the very same stereotypes caste people have traditionally applied to Dalits. Parry's findings with respect to caste are incredibly detailed and profoundly substantiated. It has been difficult for me to decide which aspects to summarize, and even with these that I have summarized, there are several important wrinkles that I have left out entirely. But what his research makes absolutely clear is the state does indeed have the power to both make and unmake caste. That it has failed overwhelmingly to do so, moreover, appears to stem as much or more from its commitment to facilitating extraction by private capital as it does to the Hindu and upper caste character of India's ruling caste, which is both undeniable, but also by now well understood. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Nate. So for those who are following, we've started with Kit talking about Johnny's labor theory and democracy and citizenship. And we've moved over to Max talking about the architecture of labor as it goes through these different, the public sector, the private sector, the construction sites. We've had Nanika talking about life and all these chapters on life and ending up with suicide and Nate talking about caste. We're going to have Christian next, Christian Strumpel talking about structuration and the Belai exceptionalism or not. And then lastly, Mao Malona talking about class. So over to Christian Strumpel now.
Yes, thanks, Alpa. Yes, structuration is a topic that runs through the book in many regards. And I mean, Giddens' concept of structuration. And Johnny uses it because, as he argues, it has a certain strength because it allows to identify key parameters in the process of how economic classes turn into social classes, freighted with social meaning and salience. And these key parameters are first, especially emphasized, social mobility across classes, within one or within one generation or within between two generations and subsequent generations. And the more of such mobility there exists, the less stable social classes are. So there are situations where households or families are multi-class, and others where they form different more separate worlds. So this is one important point. The other important point is that social structuration emphasizes to what extent social interactions of people are confined to members of their own economic class, or whether they include members of other classes as well. And these social interactions spawn very different domains or contexts. So it is about work, whether people work together from different classes, or whether they work among themselves only, or whether what lifestyles do they follow, and where do they live in town. So do they share neighborhoods, or do they live in separate neighborhoods? And Johnny argues that the strength of this concept is that that unlike social stratification models that basically trace social differentiations in all the varieties, but that fail to account for major fault lines, social fault lines, the structuration, Giddens structuration model exactly does this. So key parameters are identified, and in that sense it follows more a class model. And I think it's a very apt concept for the book, especially as my earlier commentators have said, that the book spawns a vast terrain of different situations, different domains of life. And it is exactly not just about the point of production, about factory life, but it includes, as my earlier commentators have already said, it includes many other areas of urban social life. And so I think it's a very apt concept to make sense of processes in of class formation described in the book. And what is also very important is, as Johnny emphasizes, that structuration can or even usually is uneven in a certain way, that it is more pronounced in one domain compared to other domains. And that even if structuration is very advanced, it is relative, so it's never absolute. So, and as my as earlier commentators have already pointed out, the book shows very convincingly over the trajectory of last 50 years that in the Indian city town Bilai, structuration in all key parameters that are indicated above is very advanced. So that really the working class has been divided into a salariat or a labor aristocracy on the one end of the spectrum, and on the other in the working poor or the precariat. And that because of that, one should speak better of two different classes of labor that have developed in Bilai. And as Nayanika and Maxim and Gerd have said, so no shared neighborhoods, no shared lifestyles, no shared attitudes, and no shared working lives. And what I very much like about the book and the last chapter is that Johnny emphasized that one should look at the important political ramifications this advanced structuration has. That the labor aristocracy does, because of its aristocratic status, does not fight for social citizenship rights for the working class as a whole. And that because of that, the structuration comes at a very high cost for what he terms, following Wilson, the truly disadvantaged, so the working poor. So I think this is very convincingly shown in the book in great detail. And what Johnny does in the last chapter as well, and he shows that structuration also is an important concept because it allows, it serves the purpose of comparisons across time and space. So a focus on social mobility, work and life explains crucial differences and commonalities between different industrial locations or one location in different moments of time. And in that regard, Johnny says that Biller is certainly in several ways exceptional, but that this is probably a banal proposition, that each case is exceptional in its own ways. But the important point is that structuration allows us to explain exceptionality in comparative terms, and according to these three key parameters. And Johnny then focuses in detail on other case studies in India, so to say, sister steel towns, Raukela, Jamshedpur, Durgapur, Bokaro, and also the telecommunication equipment industry in Bangalore, where Dilip Subramanian has done his excellent monograph. And he shows that ethnicity played a much larger role in some of them, and this is due to largely due to interference of ethnically defined regional states, and that at least in the case of Raukela, this interference did not only support working class unity to emerge in the place, but it also in a certain way put a brake on class structuration within the steel force, at least for some time. And he also shows that how caste still plays a role in some areas more than in others. And that in that regard, Biller is exceptional because it has this large migrant workforce community, and it's ethnically very heterogeneous. Whereas in other places like Bokaro, there's larger ethnic homogeneity, so people can place others in terms of caste. And that's why it shapes, for example, union politics in a certain way. Thirdly, and Johnny shows that also in the realm of work, and in some areas, work processes are organized and place workers according to their caste in certain work environments. And that's then a way how caste lives on. And unlike in Biller, where people are forced to cooperate closely during work, and which helps them to transcend their caste identity. And he also shows that despite these regional differences in all these different sites that he discusses in the last chapter, structuration has nevertheless advanced pretty much over the course of the last decades. And that this is due to the way the Indian state has restructured public sector industries in the wake of neoliberalization. And so that labor aristocracies who live in worlds apart from the working poor has emerged in all these different steel sites, which is of course quite a disillusioning trajectory. But Johnny emphasizes that despite this kind of trajectory, which converges in a certain sense, one should not rule out the case that relatively privileged workers sometimes identify downwards rather than upwards, rather than with the middle class upwards, and that the analytical challenge is to identify the objective conditions that favor one or other of these outcomes. And Christian, says that, sorry.
I'm so sorry, but if you don't mind ending with your questions soon,
So then I come to my questions. So one question, I mean, I have two questions, and they relate basically to how structural structuration relates to caste and to and gender. So you talk about that caste stays on. For ex untouchable caste like Satnamis, caste still stays important in their lives. So I was wondering, how does actually caste affect the class position, even of a labor aristocrat coming from an ex untouchable caste like the Satnamis? And another question is that when you compare, draw comparisons to other industries, these other industries are industries which were traditionally had large male workforces, and there are no industries in comparison which have traditionally large female workforces, so like garment industries in Bangladesh or in Trinidad. So these are my two questions. How structuration relates to caste and gender. Thanks.
Okay, so Johnny Parry's Classes of Labor is a study of the Indian working class and state through the prism of Bhilai Steel Plant and Township, created by Prime Minister Nehru in the 1940s for the liquid forces of modernity to melt away all structural caste and kinship and forge a powerful public sector working class, cosmopolitan and modern, but with a caste-like and aristocratic self-perception, and segregated from the informal working class on multiple levels, spatial, material, and cosmological, even when they are on the same shop floor. The central message of Johnny is that class outplays caste as the main mechanism of inequality, mainly between Nokri and Khan. Parry's theoretical framework is explicitly anti-Marxist, and this is the focus of my brief interrogation. First, Marx's notion of class fragmentation doesn't apply to Bhilai for three reasons. First, the notion of surplus labor and exploitation do not make sense in BSP, which, like most Indian factories, notoriously runs at a loss, and where the mechanical time and the rigid capitalist discipline is punctured by shirking, second jobs, and chronic absenteeism. Second, the rigid dichotomy between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat based on ownership of means of production is too blunt. Instead of having the capitalist and the proletarian confronting each other on two divided camps, here it's the Nokri and the Khan who confront each other on as respectively the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. Instead of the wage relation being fragmented at the point of production, as for Michael Burawoy, and formal and informal labor being relationally entangled within the same wage contract, here we have two different relations of production within the same plant, one public and the other private. Lastly, class is not the result of antagonism between the capitalist and the workers, according to Johnny, because here it is the state that is the capitalist. Quote, it is the state that creates different classes of labor, end quote. In this sense, Marx is wrong to think about the state as an appendix of private capital. So let me briefly discuss these three points. With regard to the first, I think that the issue is not that state capitalism is not capitalist enough. Rather, that modernist processes of industrialization are intrinsically based on the entanglement of state and capital, private profit and state redistribution. From this angle, the BSP shop floor is a classic instance of hegemonic capitalism, a regime in which the workers' game, jokes, and flirting reproduce the capitalist discipline mediated by the state. In this sense, Nehruvian capitalism is not dissimilar from Keynesian capitalism of, in Brazil, Vargas Estado Novo of the Workers' Party. Secondly, the fragmentation between Nokri and Khan is internal to the BSP, but unrelated to social relations of production. Parry says that these are two different working classes from the Weberian point of view, in terms of lifestyle and identity. But in fact, in Parry's description of class, I recognize more André Bataille rather than Weber. I quote, "The inequality of class have an aura of inevitability and naturalness by the spirit of hierarchy on which the caste order is founded. Class has superseded caste as a dominant axis of inequality," end quote. Rather than caste not being important, we realize that in fact caste is the framework to which class is experienced. So when Johnny says that class fragmentation between the bourgeois and the proletarians is internal, it means internalized.
this internalization operates at the biopolitical level and is so strong to transcend the shop floor and cut through bonds of kinship and ethnicity. But what is the source of this biopower? The answer is the state, the third point in Paris' criticism of Marx's class analysis. I quote, "In India, private capital and organized labor have not been in conflict because they both are subordinated by the state," end quote. If the public sector operates at the loss, on which ground does the state control private capital? Is it based on monopoly over violence, as for Weber and Giddens, or is it ideology? And what is the state ideology that provides such a powerful glue to otherwise divergent historical and material forces? It seems that the Nehruvian state is experiencing Bilai as an embodiment of Brahminic ideology, one in which the public sector workers holds the inviolable right to work, to have a wife of his own stature, and to pass his material and spiritual privileges down through generations as guarantee of salvation. In terms of class fragmentation, it does not surprise us that the hardest jobs, such as coke oven charger or smelters, are performed by the lower castes. More surprising it is, says Jonning, and agreeing with Chandavarkar, how differences disappear outside the plant in the township, where the progressive, cosmopolitan, and middle class mentality of the Nokri is the norm, and the caste and ethnic segregation associated with informal and disorganized working class are present, but relegated to the fringes, in the slums and old villages now slowly incorporating to the township. If the bourgeoisified working class is too economically well off to rebel, the informal working class is too weak to be politically relevant, except in the case of the extraordinary Chhattisgarh Mukti Morcha, the militant and intersectional union of contract workers, which is the exception that confirms the rule that there is no hope for the Indian working class. My two questions pertain to speculative history. First, how would the Indian state look today had it chosen the same industrialization path of Bilai? Second, what would have happened if the trade union of the skilled workers in Tuk and Situ had supported the struggles of the Chhattisgarh Mukti Morcha, as it happens, for instance, in Brazil, where the struggle of the informal working class improved the wages and the working condition of the formal working class too? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mao, and everybody else. I think I don't want to take up any time at all and hand over straight to Jonny. Jonny, where have you disappeared? There you are.
Yes, thank you to all the very interesting comments. I'm terribly sorry. Deborah accused me of copping out and pretending that I wouldn't be able to hear the critiques, but at various points, people did just fade out, so I may not be able to entirely address many of the comments. But let me start by trying to work backwards and respond to first of all to Mao and to his final question: what would have happened if the regular workers' union had supported the radical union of the contract workers, the Chhattisgarh Mukti Morcha? I am not at all sure how to respond to that question, because the whole book is set up to show that these two groups of workers had entirely contradictory, they had no interests in common, and in the case of the BSP mines, they had competing and different interests, and the two unions were at violent loggerheads. So I just don't see what sense it makes. I'm sure you must be right, Mao, but I don't see what sense it makes to pose something that is so totally counterfactual when the whole book has provided you with, you know, a large amount of ethnography, which is supposed to show how they didn't have interests in common. So my reaction to, I mean, what Ma was saying you know, was really very interesting. I'm a bit uncomfortable. I can see how you got there, but I'm a bit uncomfortable with my analysis being characterized as anti-Marxist. It's perfectly true that I do pin my colors to a Weberian flag at the beginning, because it seems to me that I point out quite legitimately why a Marxian analysis of the situation of the Bilai steel plant workforce, you know, is not incredibly promising to start with. But, you know, what is also central to that analysis is the concept of surplus that, you know, I do actually argue that there is a relationship of exploitation within the BSP workforce where the regular workers are expropriating surplus value from the contract workforce. And that certainly is a Marxicizing type of analysis. I also place a lot of emphasis on property. But the proposition is that the property that really counts is property in state jobs and not necessarily property in land. So I wouldn't want to kind of characterize this as an anti-Marxist pitch, but as something that merely uses tools from Weber for the BSP workforce. Christian, so what Christian rightly said, I think, at the end was that for me, Giddens's notion of structuration, the main attraction it has is that it gave me a handle on trying to understand the comparative problem of why the working class, in inverted commas, is sometimes deeply fragmented by a relationship that itself looks very much like a class relationship, and why it's not, or to invoke the Africanist literature, why the labor elite sometimes identifies up and not down. And I think the notion of structuration really enables one to look at a series of dimensions, the degree of class mobility, the degree of to which people are insulated in the workplace, in their residential lives, in their associational lives, the degree to which kinship and marriage cross are bounded and closed, the degree to which consumption patterns, political attitudes, and so on are distinctive of a particular group within the manual workforce. And so, you know, what I see as the attraction of this rather awkwardly phrased notion of structuration is essentially the comparative handle that it gives us. Christian asked about how structuration relates to caste, and how the caste position of the lowest caste, the Satnamis, affects their class position. And I think I do make a point of saying that there is a sense that through the policy of affirmative action, of protective discrimination, Saddam's caste position is a major factor in them enabling them to acquire a certain kind of class, a certain position on the class hierarchy. by virtue of reservations. But I still think that in the case of the tsunamis, you know, it is that the proposition that class trumps class is modified and mitigated in the case of the lowest caste untouchables, but it's not invalid. And it's not invalid because there are endless examples where it's quite patently obvious that what really matters to the children of tsunami BSB workers, what really determines their life chances, the lifestyles that they're going to follow, their identification in life, is their class position more than their caste position. Nate also raised lots of interesting questions about caste and why I think that class trumps caste. And that came up in Hiert's comments. Tanyanika, the final question that she ended with was why this book took me so long to, why it went on and on forever and ever. Partly being driven out of London by being made the convener of the anthropology department at the LSE, a job that was so tedious and boring that going to India every year was an absolute necessity for my mental health. That was much more serendipity, and the sheer interest of working in Belai and working in particular with Ajay. She also mentioned the tracking of individual biographies, and I find this sort of quite interesting. The book that I'd written, the ethnography I'd written of Benares, I remember that David Gellner wrote quite a very astute review of it. And David Gellner had criticized Death in Benares for the lack of individual biographies. And I'm not sure that I, was so struck by, I don't know that David Gellner necessarily had a key influence on it, but the fact was that the nature of the ethnography in Belai was such that people really did want to talk about individual stories in a way that really contrasted, and I wrote about this a little bit at the beginning of the book and in a separate paper. They wanted to talk in terms of events and stories, and they didn't want to talk in terms of big structural principles and rules and so on. So I think that the number of stories that come out in the book are partly a reflection of the nature of the society and the nature of what people wish to talk about. Janneke also asked whether what difference it made that the fieldwork went on for so long. And obviously the most important difference was that it made it much more difficult to write about, because one was aware that things that were true at the beginning of the fieldwork were not were not necessarily true at the end of it. And, one was always chasing a moving target. So I'm Max's question about is Noel Cree just an emic gloss? I'm not sure that I entirely follow that question either, because I thought that I'd made it quite clear that it's not just an emic gloss for the formal, informal divide, the organized and the unorganized, because only a small proportion of unorganized sector workers are actually described as having service jobs, as having nokri, and that the real class division is exactly where my informants say it is, where they locate it, when they use this vocabulary of nokri and kaam. It's perhaps one thing I'd like to say, partly as a random response to Kiert, is that I have been struck over the period of COVID lockdown about the extent to which this analysis of a major division within the manual labor force has, as far as I can judge, been really rather resoundingly validated by the experience of those who have nokri, who have on the whole survived pretty well, and that all the pictures we see on our televisions of people walking along highways to get back to their villages in Bihar are those who do not have nokri. And I think perhaps I should stop wittering on.
Thank you, Johnny. Thank you. I can see that Itai and various other people already have a beer. I know Gavin's, it's too early in Canada and probably far too late in India, but here's a glass to you, Johnny, and to all the discussants. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you all, and thank you for organizing it, and to the discussants for their very interesting and generous responses, which I really do apologize. I haven't been able to do any justice to at all.
We do have 10 minutes left of the official time. So I'd like to invite maybe a few questions all together. And then for those of us who'd like to stay on for longer, you're more than welcome to stay. What you need to do to raise your hand is, just put it up in the, look at your picture, and you should be able to see a raise hand function. So if you could raise your hand so I can know that you'd like to ask a question. There's about 9 pages on my screen, so I can't possibly see everybody who raises their hand. So if you could please let me know. Jens, I've got Jens, and I've got Max who wants to ask a question. Though Max, I'm going to see if there's anybody else who wants to go before you, since you've had a say. I'll ask Jens to ask his question. If in the meantime you have questions, please put your hand up and raise the blue hand. Okay, I can see John and various other people, but if you can use the function on your computer screen, that would be brilliant. But if you can't, I'll try and try and look out for you. Jens, over to you, and then John. John Harris.
Thanks, and thanks to Johnny for this fantastic book, which I have the pleasure of being mentioned in it, because I'm one of the ones who have been using the term classes of labor in a slightly different way to Johnny. There's no doubt that the book shows that there are major differences between these groups that Johnny terms different classes of labor. I wonder if, in spite of that, there aren't also similarities in interest at some level, and whether the book wouldn't have gone even further in its analysis if it also had discussed that to some extent. And here I'm thinking of, for example, right now we're seeing in India the rolling back of labor legislation. We're seeing the 8 hours day being replaced by up to a 15 hours day in many parts of India. We're seeing the new labor laws that is hurting both permanently and non-permanent laborers, and we're seeing unions that actually are campaigning in principle on behalf of both groups to roll back those kind of issues. And to me, that suggests that if one analyzed the relationship between different types of labor group and Indian capitalism, one would see that in spite of those differences, which certainly are there, and I have seen them myself as well, and you see the battle against permanent and non-permanent laborers now current calm, there are also a level where they actually have same interest and where their interest organizations try to push that common interest to the benefit of both groups.
Yeah.
Johnny, if you just hold on for a second, I'm going to ask Max to ask his question. And then I've also got Partho Shome. Is that right, Partho? Yeah, okay.
Sorry. There's also John before Harris.
Before Max, I did have John ahead of you. Sorry, John.
It's really, this is such a great occasion. It's wonderful to be a little bit, have a little part of it, to be here. Thank you so much, Alpa, for organizing it. And thank you, Johnny, for writing such a great book. I do want to ask you, though, I suppose a question really about, I wonder why you didn't reflect more on why Mark Holmstrom and also Jan and I myself, in a sense, retreated from the citadel idea to the mountain idea. And I think that was because all of us were so conscious of the very many different segments of the labor market. That it's actually it seemed to us a very much more complicated sort of picture than the one that is depicted in the idea of the citadel. And I sort of feel one of the aspects of your analysis which sort of bothers me is the way in which you kind of shunt off so many other groups of workers into this sort of peripheral kind of zone. They're kind of either on the way up into having nokri or on the way down into just being calm. I feel that's just a little bit of it bothers me that there's such a large group of workers whose, if you will, class vocation is ambiguous in relation to your analysis. The second point I want to make quickly has to do with politics, which, as you know, I feel is rather, except for the discussion of the CMM, rather missing from your analysis, because I think in other contexts, and this kind of rather relates to Geert's very good sort of question about what about places in which there's nothing like the BSP. In other places, as I think I've observed it, workers who I think you would describe as having nokri and those with calm actually come together in political action, as I believe they have done and do, for example, in Tamil Nadu. Lots of sorry.
Yeah.
No.
Thanks, John. Max?
In case it adds anything, and to clarify, what I'd been trying to push you on was not premised on nokri and calm and formal and informal mapping onto each other. That I understood. The issue is that legal compliance seems somewhat discretionary in the picture you present, and so lots of formal workers do calm, that's clear. The question is whether nokri just describes the more restrictive permanence, or whether the nokri calm binary in any sense legitimates and even shapes the uneven and selective approach to the law taken by employers here.
Thank you, Max. I'm going to ask Partho Shome and then Jan Brehman. If you could be brief, that would be fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, very broadly, from what I understand, caste is being overtaken by economic class. I mean, that's a big thrust in the book, which I haven't read, but now I will. Could it be demonstrating the principle of competition that translates into exclusion sooner or later? Yes.
Could you, I just lost the link.
Oh, okay. Could this overtaking of caste by economic class, which is a big thrust in your book, could it be demonstrating the principle of competition that translates into exclusion sooner or later? Thus, irrespective of whether differentiation emanates from castes or from economic class, it is the animal spirits that will lead in an emergent class to dominate through exclusion. I must confess, I'm not an anthropologist, but an economist. So this kind of one, as you explained, different castes mix and invite one another into their homes because now they belong to the same class. So the lower castes that got up there through their enterprise and entrepreneurship, they seem to have moved up or consider themselves to be moved up and commiserate with the upper class, upper castes. So it's class intersection that excludes the lower castes by simply forming new class. So it's exclusion that is important.
Thank you.
I mean, it's a question, yeah.
Thank you, Jan Brehman. And then I'm gonna give you a minute, Johnny, to respond, but we can keep this floor open for longer. So yeah, Jan.
Johnny, I'll be very brief, and you might even be briefer. The fieldwork stopped in 2014, and so does the analysis. And as you said, the field workers the issue at stake is a moving target. The role of the state has changed enormously with the coming to power of the Hindutva Jagannath. And they have taken over state power also. And this follows up on what John Harris said on the political angle. They have taken over state power and suppress any class structuration that is around and is articulated. They want caste to trump class in the Hindutva agenda. Could you care to comment on that, Johnny?
Okay, I mean, let me respond to what I heard of Jan immediately. Yes, of course. The analysis stops in 2014. It is possible that the situation, you know, is in significant ways modified since that time. But what really strikes me, and this is part of my response to Jens's original comment, is that to a very surprising extent, though the degree to which those within the citadel, you know, the citadel has been under attack for now decades through neoliberal policies and so on. And it's certainly true that the size of the citadel has shrunk. But as far as I can make out, anyway, up till beyond 2014, Jan, the privileges of those with Sarkari have actually stood up remarkably well. Their pay remains fantastically high in relation to most industrial in places, you know, SAIL employees are not being retrenched. The workforce is being reduced through natural wastage and so on. So I think that, it's a matter that needs empirical investigation, but the extent to which events since 2014 and the apparent triumph of Hindutva have actually undermined the privileges. John Harris has done absolutely sterling duty by this book. He's not only done an interview with me, but written a joint review. So I'm very grateful for John's input. Why John wants to know, did I not take Jan Bremen, John Harris, Mark Holmstrom more seriously when they retreated from a more dichotomous position to one of infinite gradations? That certainly my experience in Belai suggests that there is, you know, there are lots of differentiations within the ranks of those who have come, but the really big distinction is between those who have regular employment and those who do work. So I'm willing to completely roll over and apologize for having tried to adopt a revisionist position that took us back to what all of these three authors had been saying before they lost their nerve.
Well, on that note, Johnny, on that note, on that challenge, here's to you, here's to everybody, here's to,
Well, thank you all so much for participating and taking an interest. I'm very grateful.